Hello, my name's Tamsin Westhorpe and welcome to Fresh from the Pod Gardening Stories. Now in this episode I talk to my youngest guest yet, Arthur Parkinson. He works with Sarah Raven to create those catalogues that we all just drool over and can't resist. He's an expert in container gardening, adores growing cut flowers, and he also has a passion for keeping poultry. Now, I truly believe that Arthur has a unique style and is someone who will drive us forward to garden in the future. He really is someone to watch, and I know he's going to be one of our most important gardeners. So I hope you enjoy this conversation as I get to know the truly inspiring Arthur Parkinson. Arthur, thank you for joining me on Fresh from the Pod. Well, I've come up with this nickname for you, which I hope you're not going to mind, the Poldark of Pots.
That's very flattering. Thank you.
And I think, you know, you are our horticultural heartthrob at the moment. So what does that feel like?
I don't know, really. I don't feel like one.
I've embarrassed you from the off. Now, I wanted to talk to you about something that is serious, and it's rats. Okay, we know you love your chickens, but I had to get rid of my chickens because of rats. What am I doing wrong?
Well, it's really funny you start off with this because it's a passionate subject of mine regarding hens. All birds hate rats because rats naturally would kill the chicks and take the eggs. So when people say to me, all chickens give you rats, I often bite back and say, no, it's because you're keeping them in a, not a poor way, possibly a lazy way. So I would suggest having the hen house always a good 3 foot off the floor. There was a company a while ago that used to sell very expensive hen houses on saddle stones, and also using rat proof feeders because it's chicken feed that the rats come for. And yeah, if you've just got a hopper that's got, you know, a weekend's worth of chicken feed in, the rats are just going to see that as a banquet. So it's exactly the same as when you've got that neighbour from hell next door who decides to put out a whole loaf of bread on the bird table. You know, if you're going to feed the wild birds like that, you're going to get rats, and it's the same with chickens. And quite often you have that romantic image, yeah, of having the hens at the back of the garden with the compost heap next to them, quite tucked away. It just becomes very quickly a very un-Pride and Prejudice romantic situation where your hens are, you know, have got to put up with the rats. So I don't know how you were keeping your hens, Tamsin. I'm sure it was lovely, but I would imagine there was a feed issue, possibly. I might be wrong.
Yeah, my neighbours have got chickens as well. So we've created a sort of rat run, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, I'm just going to ask the question.
No, it's a really good question.
Yeah, and I'm sad to not have the hens. And I'm thinking, oh, I must get some more hens.
Yeah.
But I can't stand a rat.
Is anything of what I've just said registered? Would you agree? Or were you thinking, well, actually, I was keeping the hens in a really good way and there was no issue with feed? Or do you think maybe there was feed lying around to attract them?
I think I probably left too much feed out, like you say, using the hopper.
Yeah, there's some really good rat-proof feeders now.
Okay, right, maybe try again.
Yeah, I would.
For people that haven't come across you, you are all about container gardening, chickens, cut flowers. And I just wanted to ask you, really, when did this passion start for gardening? What age were you? Were you, you know, 7, 8 or later?
I think the hens came first, and I was lucky. I had two parents who weren't really gardeners, but although we were in a town, they really tried hard to make sure me and my brother loved the countryside. We also had grandparents who, rather than taking us, you know, to a package holiday in the Canary Islands, we used to go to Derbyshire. So I was always very lucky to be immersed, not in farming and gardening, but within a world that explored it. So we'd see the little allotments and the veg patches and the chickens when we were very small in the buggy and pram, you know. So I think it started young, and then my parents split up and the gardening became a thing that just took my mind off it. I didn't do well at school. I was a very creative child, but academically I was awful. Didn't learn to read till I was, you know, pushing 7. And it was gardening books and chicken books that I actually wanted to read. So I'd be looking at, you know, Reader's Digest gardening books and, you know, books that were quite adulty. So it was always there. But yeah, it was early on. Yeah.
I think what's lovely about you is you've kind of got two gardens, haven't you, that you borrow. So you've got your mum's garden where all your pots are, and then you've got your nan's garden where your chickens are.
Yeah.
And I get this feeling with you that although you've been to Kew, although you know what you're doing, I get this feeling that you're following your own path. You're not sort of one of these people that would look at a how-to gardening book. Am I right?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I didn't get on well at all at Kew because I remember like the first week being asked to learn 10 different Latin names for conifers. I didn't learn one because I don't like conifers.
Brilliant.
I'm glad I went, but it was so high-end horticulture. I survived by the skin of my teeth, you know, I think purely due to the fact I was quirky and happy to garden. Whereas, you know, when it came to Latin and the botany side, I was hopeless. And I remember being asked to, you know, work 5 different lawnmowers, you know, all the kind of tests that you have to do at Kew. And it was a real, like a nightmare, really. But I remember, you know, I can name most dahlias, I can name most parrot tulips, the flowers that I love, I'm very passionate and have learned a lot about. But no, I wouldn't go to a how-to book. I'm not afraid to go, I love that. Whereas I noticed that a lot of people want to follow a trend possibly, or, you know, are scared of being dominant of what they like in a garden. And I've never really had that issue.
But it's interesting because a lot of the great gardeners, you know, Christopher Lloyd, etc., he didn't follow the rule book. And I actually think it should be encouraged to sort of go out there and go, what the hell, this is what I like, this is what I'm doing. And I think this lockdown has been quite interesting because I've discovered loads of gardeners on Instagram that are doing things their own way. Do you think, although this has been a hell of a horrible time, that it has actually loosened up the gardening world?
Yeah, massively. I think thanks to Instagram, primarily, it's opened up a whole new gardener's world that we didn't have before. I think from the company perspective, because gardening is otherwise quite a lonely thing, I think a lot of people have grasped the community through this lockdown. And I think gardens have become just as important for a lot of people as the house, you know, whereas before, the garden was like the last thing on a lot of people's minds. It'd be like people would see the garden as a bit of a time thing that they hadn't got to love. And I think people have learned to love their gardens through lockdown. And I think a lot of people will say, well, actually, I don't want to go back to 9-to-5-ing. I want to work from home and you know, garden during my lunch break.
Yeah.
So I think it's been really good from a gardening perspective.
I do. Yeah. And let's hope it lasts.
Mm.
You work with Sarah Raven, don't you?
Helping
her to create these wonderful collections that we all drool over.
I'm glad you do.
God, that catalogue with Jonathan Bucks's pictures.
I know.
It's a naughty spend book, isn't it?
It is.
But tell us how that relationship started, because didn't you read a book of Sarah's and you just sort of got attracted to her style of gardening?
Well, I remember seeing Sarah when I was little. I used to watch Gardener's World with my Nana Min, which is where I keep my hens. And I do remember specifically Sarah being in a lovely hexagon-shaped greenhouse and she was sowing sweet peas into root trainers, which is something I do at this time of year all the time. And I remember just thinking, God, she's really beautiful and elegant. And so then I found the Bold and Brilliant Garden book in the library, which was Jonathan Butler's photograph. Mm. It wasn't a how-to book, but it was Sarah writing about the Oast Garden, which is, for those of you that don't know, it's part of the garden at Sarah's, which is very jungly and flower dominating gardener almost. You know, all the dahlias and gladioli and tulips are there, but they're very natural suedes and rich stained glass tones. So that's what the Bold and Brilliant Garden book was about. And I just remember thinking, this is Eden, you know, done by a goddess, and this is what I want my life to be like. But it wasn't until I was working at Kew and I was a bit closer to Sussex that I started to get the train to visit Sarah on her open days. And Sarah liked me, luckily, from the off. And then I left Kew and she said, would you come and house sit for me? Which I did. And she got back and I'd picked lots of vases of flowers. And ever since, I've worked for Sarah.
Crikey. So floristry, you're not a trained florist or
no.
You're just a natural creator?
Not at all. My mum always, I mean, what was lovely about going to Sarah's house, it was the first house I'd been in that reminded me of my mum's little cottage, Mill Yard, because Sarah, you know, you can imagine shelves full of vases and lovely ceramics. My mum's house was very similar. So it was a lovely scene. I remember that very vividly, thinking, gosh, another house like my mum's house, you know, this person, all these vases, beautiful, you know, jam jars just waiting to be filled with flowers. So no, I'm not trained. I like to see flowers in water. You know, I don't understand the whole situation we're slowly moving out of, which is using Oasis. I don't understand how we've become so addicted to these horrible blocks of plastic. Yeah. So, yeah.
But it's interesting. I've been to Perch Hill once, and as soon as you arrive, it kind of gets you, doesn't it? It's like stepping back in time. Although Sarah's got modern ideas, they're sort of set in the past, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
There's something really homely and safe about it, isn't there?
Yeah, I think it's the looseness, yet it is productive and beautiful. And the setting, you know, she was very clever. She had to plant hawthorn hedges as soon as she started to garden there because of the wind. So you've got the kind of, you know, the room-like element that a lot of gardens need. And then it's just, you know, a shoebox that's filled with all this vibrancy and growth. And I love that it's changing all the time. You know, nothing is permanent. It's constantly annuals or tender perennials. So nothing is stagnant apart from these, you know, the hedges.
Yeah, no, gorgeous place. If people haven't been, they need to go.
Yeah, we've got lots of open days.
Yeah, but you're fascinating, really, that it strikes me that all your sort of heroes and that people have inspired you have been very strong women.
Yeah.
So I know that you had a relationship with the Dowager Duchess of Devonshire.
Yeah.
Talk me through that one.
Well, that was due to my granddad, who found me with my head halfway through a pop hole. And that's, for those of you that don't know, a hen house entrance. And I remember him saying I would have only been six. He said, oh, I think you should write to the lady that owns these chickens. Because at that time she'd got 200 chickens free ranging in the car park, which was, you know, where you parked your car going into Chatsworth, and you'd have a picnic and just be surrounded by chickens.
Wow.
So it was wonderful. And so I just wrote to this person. I didn't know who she was, really. And that's the lovely thing about being a child. You don't have any idea of grandeur, really, in terms of humans. Within, you know, a week of sending off just a little letter, I'd got a postcard from Lismore Castle, which was where she was staying at the time. And we corresponded until she lost her eyesight. So that was very lovely to have her as like a chicken friend.
If you Google her, there's some quite dramatic images of her, aren't there? We're surrounded by these hens. I don't know if you've seen them.
Yeah. The Bruce Weber ones.
Yeah, they're just iconic, aren't they? Absolutely stunning.
Yeah, she was beautiful.
And the thing that sort of strikes me looking at your Instagram is your chickens add so much decoration, drama, don't they?
Yeah.
To your plot.
Yeah, they do. They give movement.
Yeah. And if you had to pick a breed of hen, I know what I would pick, but what's your top pick for beauty?
For beauty, I think the little Barbadookos are really good because they're a bit like a Peking, but they don't go broody every 5 minutes, which can be annoying with the fancy ones, the ones that just want to sit on eggs for 6 months of the year. But the fancy ones that don't go broody but still look lovely and are so small that they don't trash the flowers, they're really lovely to have.
Yeah, because that is an issue with hens. I do love Buff Orpingtons. My mum always had Buff Orpingtons. But they go broody, don't they, for quite a while?
Yeah, they do. And they can still be quite ploddy amongst delicate things, even because they're quite a big bird, aren't they?
Big birds, yeah.
Unless you've got a hosta border, I probably wouldn't suggest having them.
No.
But no, they're lovely for a big garden. You're quite right.
Yeah, very showy. And the other hen that my mother always used to have great success with for egg production was the marrons. With the brown eggs.
Yeah, I love those. They're very beautiful, aren't they? Yes.
Very.
And it is nice to collect eggs as well. I miss collecting eggs, just having fancy ones.
You're not a cook, are you? I've read somewhere. Am I wrong?
Not at all.
Am I being unfair?
No, you're totally right. I'm awful. If I was to do a dinner party, I would be one of those people that go to Waitrose and decant a lasagna into a baking tray.
So what do you do with your eggs?
I like to give them to people. You know, it's lovely to give eggs to people. And quite often the hens want to sit on them anyway. So it's not an issue, really.
I would have thought you'd be baking cakes.
No, I'm not like Charlie McCormack, sadly. It is kind of the thing that a lot of people think. And I remember when Sarah first asked me to, she asked me to give her some cheese or something, and I'd never even cut up a block of cheese. And she looked, that was quite a funny evening. I literally gave her a whole slab of Stilton or something. It's quite funny. I have got better. I've got a bit better, but no, I'm not a cook.
Okay, we'll let you off. You can't do everything. So talk me through your lockdown experience. Has it been a complete nightmare, or have you secretly, see, parts of it I've quite liked. I've quite liked just being at home. What's your story?
I've secretly loved it. And it was interesting early on in lockdown, Will Young, I think, published a story. He was talking to a therapist, and this therapist said, anybody who suffers from anxiety or depression, it's been like the Pandora's box of having that blissful excuse of saying, actually, I can't come out today, I'm shutting the door.
Yeah.
And for me, certainly the first lockdown was heaven. I moved in with my Nana Min and I looked after her. And we kind of felt like we were on this desert island. I'm sure you remember the sky was like that gorgeous azure blue and the blossom was out. It was very warm. So, you know, we had gin and tonic in the garden and hens all went broody, so it was just hatching loads of chicks, and I just went dahlia mad. I planted up, you know, 12 supermarket crates worth of dahlias. But then I noticed that I was gradually becoming crazy. The dressing gown was staying on till 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and it's a slippery slope, I think, for those of us that have to force ourselves to be social. To get out of that routine, I think, is going to be a real battle to get back into. Just being able to put a smile on and being like, oh, we're back to 9 to 5 now, you've got to act your way through being social. I think that's going to be a massive issue for a lot of people.
I mean, it's such a surreal thing, isn't it, that we can all dedicate ourselves to our gardens and suddenly we might not be able to do that. Do you think that you're going to be able to cope with that? I mean, I don't know. With me, I think, crikey, if I suddenly had to go away for a week in London and do some work, do I want to anymore? It does make you reevaluate, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm lucky I work for Sarah, so she's very good at giving me dates in my diary. And I think when you're working for people rather than plants, it's different because you can't let people down. And, you know, we do courses and away days. So when I've got those dates, I know that regardless, I've got to be on it and do it for her. And do it, you know, 30 people who've paid a lot of money to come and be taught how to garden. But it's more about the day-to-day in between that I struggle with a bit more. But the garden helps, you know, if you sow a load of sweet peas now, you know, you've got to nurture them until April when they get planted out. And then as soon as April comes, you're constantly sowing seeds and planting dahlia tubers. So I like the style of having the annual garden because you're constantly inputting growth and energy. And I think it gives you energy back through all that colour and vitality. So that's why I love growing cut flowers, because you're constantly looking ahead, not just next year, but, you know, next week, all through the year.
Gosh, that's really interesting, actually. So would you say you suffer from anxiety?
Yeah, massively.
And
yeah.
Do you think you could now do anything else? I mean, it's really interesting. I've spoken to a lot of people when doing my podcast and say, you know, if you hadn't done gardening, where would you be? And the lovely thing about horticulture is it does allow people that suffer in that way to sort of create and heal. And is there another job you could do?
Yeah, I mean, I nearly went into zoology because I love exotic birds. So that was always something that I was torn between doing. I always thought maybe I'd end up being a gardener in a zoo or being a zookeeper, looking after parrots and flamingos. But I find that I do need that human interaction. I'm not very good if I'm just stuck in a garden completely on my own. I tend to go a little bit mad and a bit razor sharp if I'm not made to put a smile on and be helpful to people. And that's why I love teaching with Sarah, because it's the interaction, the conversation. When I was at Kew, I noticed these old gardeners who were just on a leaf blower all day long, and they were just desperate to talk. Plants are lovely, but they don't give you that stimulus of being nurtured. You know, a gladioli can't hug you. It can only give you a visual joy.
Yeah, I worked at Bournemouth Parks Department when I was a lot younger, and I wasn't really aware of mental health issues in those days. And it was really interesting. There was a massive rock garden there, and whoever worked there had to work there on their own. And it was almost like a prison sentence. People would go, "Oh no, I've moved on to the rock garden," because you're high up, you're away from the public, so you'd spend all day, every day on your own. And like you say, it's not good.
Not good at all. And one thing I possibly would have gone into, having now looked after my nana who suffered from dementia, I do have a massive urge to try and get gardens into care homes. So I wouldn't necessarily be a carer, but certainly if I ever got any backing, I'd love to somehow get gardeners working in care homes, because I think that's a massive thing that's lacking for sufferers of dementia and Alzheimer's.
Because it does, certain plants bring back their memory.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So did you find there was anything that you grew that your nana sort of smiled at and really related to?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Min always had a very dedicated vegetable garden, full on old fashioned double digging, potatoes, whole bed of leeks, purple sprouting, doing some runner beans and then bringing them in for it to depod. You know, she loved that. And I think it's the smells of fresh herbs. I mean, I've been in care homes. My granddad went in a care home. And to not have that stimulation for that generation, I think, has been really horrific. I mean, we hear a lot about gardens in hospitals and children's nurseries, but the whole care home situation seems to be, at the moment, forgotten.
And also, the people that are in care homes, they grew up shelling their own beans. And it's like part of them, isn't it? That's a very good point, actually. That needs looking at, doesn't it?
If I win the lottery, I'll do that. That's what I'll do as my legacy.
Well done. Do you play the lottery though?
I should start to, but I'm not a gambler.
Yeah.
So I do need to start doing the lottery.
So when it comes to colours and your sort of mood, are there colours that you think, I've got to have that in my garden, that makes me feel good?
Yeah.
Or are there colours that you avoid? What's your colour feel-good factor?
I think it's always, I call them the trifle tones, you know, when you have that lovely bit of Swiss roll and the jelly, cocktaily colours, limes. I always want rich colours. I do like white, but it's got to be on its own, I'm afraid. You know, I love the white garden at Sissinghurst, but the genius of that is that Vita just wanted white on its own. And when white is on its own, it becomes just beautiful to me. Whereas if you put white in amongst a beautiful marmalade dahlia bed, I'm sorry, I just see hazard car flashing lights amongst it. But yeah, so jazzy tones, very jungly tones, they're the ones that I always go for.
What about yellow, though? Because it's really interesting. When I go to garden talks, I always ask at the beginning, does anyone dislike yellow? And I guarantee you there will be one or two people that always put their hand up.
We've got, at the moment, some daffodils I bought yesterday, and they're the lovely wild, that lemon posset yellow. And I like that yellow. I don't like the worker's jacket builder yellow. Although I think if the form's right, like a beautiful, not necessarily beautiful, but there's a dahlia called Bishop of York, which is yellow. But it's a single dahlia, it's like a star. And I have to say, you know, in the evening, like, or at first light, yellow can look lovely. It's the same with a tulip called Dance Line or Dance Girl, and that's yellow. And Tulip West Point as well. They can all look nice, but if they're in shade where they can, you know, look like little candles, they can look good. But yeah, I wouldn't put yellow at the top of the list, but I don't hate it. It's just, as long as it's rich,
yeah,
it's nice.
So pastels are not your thing?
I'm afraid not, no. Going back to care homes and hospitals, I don't want those colours in the garden. I want energy and vibrancy and, you know, flamenco dancing, not end of life mode.
I think we all need a bit of flamenco dancing at the minute. Gosh, wouldn't that be good? Now, I wanted to talk to you about your writing, and I love the story that, you know, you didn't start reading and writing till 7, and now you're an author.
Yeah.
So you've written a book called The Pottery Gardener, when you were with Emma Bridgewater working there, and your new book comes out. You can pre-order it, can't you, now?
Yes, you can. Yeah, if you want a signed copy, you can go on Sir Raven, and it's on Amazon, The Flower Yard.
the flower yard. So what can we expect from that book?
Well, hopefully I'll live up to your lovely title of Poldark of Pots, I hope, because it is a book about pots all through the year.
Good.
So if you like what you see on my Instagram, really, it's a very detailed account of how I grow my cutting garden in pots. So it's about how I see the garden as being a place for wildlife, you know, bees, butterflies, birds, as well as a place to have cut flowers from, all in pots. So it's about how I grow my sweet peas in dolly tubs, dahlias, cosmos, everything's in there. Apart from two photos, they're all my own photos as well. So it's been a 4 year kind of like project since doing my first book, The Pottery Gardener.
But incredible, really, that you're taking your own photographs, you're writing books, and you're only, you're in your 20s, aren't you?
Yes, I'm just still in my 20s.
Which is quite remarkable, really.
Yeah.
Do you feel that you're achieving things? Do you feel that you're cracking the egg as such?
I feel like I want to do things now rather than wait. When people say, oh, why are you gardening now? Why are you doing all this now? Why aren't you just in Ibiza as a bartender or something? I say, well, I don't want to wait. I want to make sure I'm doing it now while I'm, you know, invigorated by it. It's just something that I enjoy doing. And yeah, I mean, it's hard going. No one comes to you and says, oh, we want you to do this book, at least not yet. I'm sure maybe that happens to people like Nigella Lawson, maybe. But when you're, you know, the little fish in the big pond, that doesn't happen. You have to do the hard work and writing, you know, long synopsises and things. But the photos I love doing, it's the photos that kind of have made me want to do both of these books, because you're constantly doing the photos and you think, gosh, I've got to use these for something.
Yeah, capture that memory. It's like a diary, isn't it? Everybody to see.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Do you do your own photos? Because you've done books, haven't you?
Yes, I've written a diary and I did do my own photos. And I think the reason for that is I'm not a brilliant photographer, but I know what I'm trying to show people. When you're gardening, it's very personal, isn't it? You know, I want them to see this plant in this way, in this light.
Yeah, the way you see it. Yeah.
So it's really interesting to have different photographers. I mean, you can probably spot Jonathan's photographs a mile off.
Yeah.
So it is important that we have different photographers out there capturing things in different ways.
Yeah, especially now that so much can be done to a photo with Lightbox and things. I mean, I've been lucky to know Jonathan as long as I've known Sarah, and he is incredible and so lovely. And, you know, I think just looking at his work has helped me a lot. I remember Sarah saying to me, one of the first things when I was showing my photo, she said, think about the effing background. And that stayed with me forever, because you can take a lovely close-up, but, you know, if there's a leg of a chair in the background of that flower portrait, it's no good at all. So it's things like that that you learn, I think.
And you learn by mistakes. I mean, gosh, I have as a journalist. And,
yeah.
And one mistake I made, you reminded me on the phone the other day that you had rung me when I was editing The English Garden to either offer me some work or, you know, and I didn't use you and I'm appalled with myself. It's terrible.
No, because I wasn't good enough then. I used to say I'm good enough now, but it's a cutthroat world and there's a lot of gardens out there and a lot of people that want their garden to be shown off. So you have to be patient. And I think that's another thing that gardening teaches you. It is to be patient. You have to wait 6 months to see those tulips that you've seen in Holland in your own garden. You know, it is about being patient. It doesn't happen overnight.
But I'm totally with you when you say you should be doing this now, because I'm in my 40s now and it's really interesting. This sounds really awful, but every year I find it physically harder to do what I do.
Yeah.
It's all very well people saying, oh, leave it, you know, get a proper job and then do it. But actually what's so great is to have the physical energy to pull off what you want to do.
Yeah, I agree. Definitely. If the mind's willing but the body isn't, can't do it. Can you?
Yeah, and I'm worried about that. Are you worried about that in the future? You know, you think of yourself as a 70-year-old man.
What I say to Sarah is, what are we going to do when my back gives way? Because we go on our away days in a big purple van, me, Sarah, and our friend Caroline, who's a genius and helps do the shop.
Yeah.
And I say, what we're going to do when I start getting old and can't jump in and out this van, you know, crate after crate.
Yeah.
So we'll have to find another Arthur once I get to, I don't know, 50.
What's interesting is when I do my garden talks, a lot of the people that go are retired, and I always get this question saying, oh, Tamsin, isn't it tragic that there aren't any younger people joining the industry? But I don't see that. Do you think there's a shortage, or what's your thoughts being a younger person?
I think there's not necessarily a shortage of young people wanting to garden. I think there's a shortage of good people teaching the young people who want to garden. I remember when I did my OHS Level 3 at Nottingham Trent University, there were about 10 lads my age who started the course. I was the only one who finished the course. They all dropped out. And I think it was a real issue with having, sadly, a lot of lecturers who were very old school, who didn't inspire. And unfortunately, it's not the best paid industry. It's not given the calibre of other industries. And I think until that changes, I always remember at Q saying, why isn't there, you know, lectures on just Eden and what the Garden of Eden should be and what we should all be seeing gardens as, you know, a place for bees, a place for birdsong, a place for mental health. I didn't feel there was any of that within the curriculum of my garden study. I had to go and find that myself, you know, through reading The Bold and Brilliant Garden and having people like Sarah. I didn't find any inspirational creativity really through my studying of gardening, sadly.
And I think it's very much the rule book of gardening, isn't it?
Mm.
And it's a bit like we need to add in that creative flair, have quite quirky lecturers. I mean, I remember being at boarding school and we had, this is years ago now, we had a travelling gypsy that used to come every Wednesday and teach sculpture. And he was amazing. The horse and cart would be in the drive at school. And I've never forgotten him. He made me want to be a gardener because I wanted to create garden sculptures. Not that I ever have, but
yeah.
That's the sort of people that you need, isn't it?
Definitely. You need character. So it's not just about plants. It's about people and getting those characters who are stimulated by plants to inspire you.
Yeah.
Massively.
So what's next for you? I mean, I know last year you were planned to do a Hampton Court garden, wasn't it?
Yeah.
What's your dream? Where does Arthur want to be when he's my age?
I'm going to stay with Sarah because I really do love working for her. I love what we do. I'm very lucky to have a job where I've got a friendship with my boss, basically. And it's a very lovely thing, you know, doing those collections and putting colours together. So that's my bread and butter. I want to do more books. The next book will be about chickens. Mm. Although I've mentioned hens in both my books, I've not done a dedicated chicken book. So hopefully COVID will be over by, you know, April, or we'll at least be able to move around. I've got a lot of photography of hens to do to make sure that book is hopefully out for 2022, if I can get a move on.
Excellent.
I'll be able to do more things with my photos. And why not do a calendar and things like that? And just raise awareness for the things that matter to me, like gardening for bees and animal welfare. That's what I'd like to focus on. I'll probably end up a complete crackpot, you know, in a small holding in Derbyshire. That'd be the dream with lots of chickens.
Definitely something to aspire to. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I noticed the other day that you put on Instagram that you'd seen a little greenhouse that you wanted.
Yes.
At a garden centre. That's obviously something you dream of, isn't it? Because how do you overwinter all those dahlias?
It's really hard. They're all lifted. I dry the pots out in November, so they're really dry when they get lifted, because that's the key, as you know, with dahlias. If they're wet, they go mouldy. So they're all literally in my mum's cellar, which is a converted proper room with heating in crates with all the soil knocked off. And then I just replant them in the crates with compost in April. But it's, you know, it's a very intense 5 weeks of growing them until they can be planted out.
Crikey. But isn't it great your mum's got a cellar? Mm. We've got a cellar at Stocktonbury, and we overwinter all our dahlias down there and our fuchsias, because we leave the door open and we've got light, we can have our fuchsias down there.
Oh, lovely.
And it's amazing how the apples and the potatoes just last so well. Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, to have a greenhouse, I think, is paradise. Must be.
Yeah. Oh, it is. It is. You'll have to come see mine and I'll just, yeah, you can show me what I should be doing at some stage. Going back to pots, because I wanted to ask you, and people will say, why didn't you ask him, Tamsin, what growing medium do you use?
It's a really good question, because it's changed last year I had a bit of a disaster, and I was really glad I didn't have to do photos for the book this past year, because I switched to a totally peat-free, all singing, all dancing, according to the bag mix. And the dahlias hated it. They just sent up a lot of leaf and they didn't flower well. So my soil mix that I'm switching to is going to be a mix of molehill compost, which I've got to collect myself. I'm going to mix it in with all my old compost. And I always add lots of organic chicken manure pellets and grow char fertilizer, and a tiny bit of organic blood and fish and bone, and also some well-rotted chicken muck that I do myself in my nana's garden. But I can't say to people, just use these bags of peat-free for dahlias in pots, sadly, because I've just not had good results from it.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You're not going to fill your car boot because you don't drive, do you?
No, I don't. God help the world if I did drive and had a car boot to fill up.
Yeah, you'd be out there buying.
I would.
But, I mean, you do see people in spring going to the garden centre and buying bag after bag after bag of compost.
Yeah.
And what's very interesting is you're kind of saying, if you've got the space, you can do your own mix. I mean, it sounds lovely what you're growing in.
Yeah, I mean, I do. I have a big tin bath that's on the wall that isn't planted. So every time I'm refreshing the pots, I fork out, you know, half of the soil that's in a dolly tub, and it all gets refreshed. I never chuck soil away. I think a lot of people think, oh, you're gardening pots, you're obviously having to chuck your soil away. It's something that Carol Klein said, and it's really a good thing to say. If you feed your soil, you feed your plants. So if you feed that soil, invigorate it, spend a decent bit of money on your fertilizer and the organic chicken manure, you will get good results.
Yeah. Yeah, I was driving up the road today, actually. I nearly stopped in my car because someone down the road has got ponies and they've got all these bags of horse manure. And I'm always tempted to load them in. But I made the mistake last year. I don't know if you've ever tried spent hops. We've got a local brewery. And I went to buy some beer and she brilliantly said, oh, I know you're a gardener. Do you want some of these spent hops? And I said, oh, yes, please. Oh, my goodness, the smell in the car. If I'd have been pulled over by the police, they'd have said, crikey, this woman's been drinking. So if you are driving around the car, you have to be careful what you do pick up for your compost heap. When it comes to, you were on Gardener's World this year. You filmed it yourself with your phone.
I did.
Do you have aspirations to be in front of the camera?
I do want to be. Yeah, I do, mainly because it helps sell books. So from a commercial perception, unfortunately, Gardener's World have said my garden won't be on again. So they've had enough of me. So I'm open to whatever other things get cast my way. So hopefully, you know, somehow. Well, that's one of the reasons I'd rather do books. You know, if I can get my garden out there through doing my own photos, I'll do it that way.
Yeah, we desperately need more gardening shows, don't we? Absolutely, it'd be great.
I think so, and more sexy garden shows. I mean, I've turned down several suggestions of, you know, trying to do Ground Force again, whereas I just want to be like Nigella in her kitchen, but in my garden, really.
Oh, you know. There we are. You see, now you've got the name of Poldark and Pots. You're away. You've got something to sell yourself on. Yeah. And I really do think that is what people want. They want to see someone young, fit and healthy. They want to feel like this is a cool, sexy hobby, isn't it?
And not necessarily just, you know, film me going to a garden centre and shopping like you would do if you were a cook on a cooking show, you know, going to the posh food shop.
And I remember you saying something, I don't know where I heard you say that, you know, you spend an awful lot of money on plants.
I do. There's a reason I'm still living sort of at home with my mum. There's been no saving up for a mortgage. It's all gone on tulip bulbs. So there does, maybe there will be a few years off, but I am a bit like Marie Antoinette. And it's a curse, because once you've experienced that amount of flowers, every year I say I'm not going to do it, but you bet your life, when those catalogues come, the sums start to add up.
Yeah, well, I'm very glad that you spend that amount of money and give us all inspiration. Thank you for joining me. I think you are the future, which is just so wonderful to see. And I think in Country Life, they said to you, I've written it down here, you're the rising to the top of the gardening world. There you are. And I think you are.
Well, that's very kind. Thank you. And thank you for inviting me, Tamsin.
It's been lovely. Lovely to see you.
Thank you. Hope you get some chickens again soon.
Oh, I'll let you know. I'll let you know.
Yes, please do.
Well, that was just inspiring. Arthur is definitely a gardener to watch. He is someone who will drive us, inspire us, and get us all gardening for many, many years to come. Now, Arthur brought up the topic of how gardening has helped with his mental health during the lockdown. So Candide and I have come up with this idea that the week after I've done a podcast, I will be taking over their Twitter site, which is at Candide Gardening. So my first takeover is February the 5th. It's a Friday between 6:45 and 7:45. I want to know how gardening has got you through, how it's improved your mental health. So please join me at Candide Gardening, Friday, February the 5th at 6:45. Can't wait to start a conversation with you.